Chapter 15. How did you know we'd be here? Quentin asked.
I always knew the map would lead back here eventually, Agar said. Back to my grandfather's mountain, where the Brotherhood began. Everything you said about the map being born here, it is true.
Quentin glanced at Jake. They were both thinking the same thing. Where are Nick and Kate? Are they safe?
Your grandfather's mountain, Jake said. Is that what you called it? I knew this place felt like pure evil.
Egger allowed a thin smile.
Of course. You've been programmed to think that way. The victor will always be the judge, and the vanquished the accused.
Joseph Goebbels, Quentin said. Let me guess. Your grandfather worked for him.
Goebbels poisoned the Führer's mind and betrayed his nation. My grandfather answered only to Hermann Göring.
My mistake, Quentin said. Didn't mean to offend. How did you get up here, anyway? Did your father put in a hidden elevator?
He came up the Swiss side, Jake said. Egger nodded. A brave man can drive a snow cat from Zermatt, he said. One slip of your treads and it's over. But it's considerably less taxing than traversing a mountain without one. Now, if you don't mind, the map.
Egger held out one hand, like a teacher impatiently waiting to collect homework. Quentin glanced at Jake, then at the submachine gun barrel leveled at his own chest. He took a few steps forward with the map section they'd just retrieved from the floor, handed it to Egger. He stayed directly in front of Egger, looking him in the eye.
The rest of it, Egger said.
I don't have it.
You don't strike me as a kind of man who'd trust anyone else to keep it.
Everybody else leaves this place, Quentin said, safely.
Then I'll give it to you.
Egger frowned and nodded like he was actually thinking this over, then said,
Here's my counteroffer. Franz will shoot your friend in exactly 5 seconds.
Franz redirected the gun from Quentin to Jake. Quentin's mind raced through the tactical possibilities. Egger may be armed, he thought, but he'd have to reach for his gun. Can I get to Franz before he shoots Jake? In the end, he didn't see any scenario that didn't end up with Jake dead on the floor. He unzipped his jacket, lifted up his shirt, and took off the money belt wrapped around his waist. He didn't bother opening it. He just handed it to Egger. Egger unzipped it, took out the other 4 pieces. His whole demeanor changed once he was holding the 5 map pieces together, as if they were the most precious objects in the world. Which they were. Put them together and they would lead the holder to $30 billion in gold.
Mine. God, he said, slowly shaking his head. See, Franz, these are the other pieces that forms a whole. Even if I knew the last piece would be here on the mountain, it would have meant nothing to me without the others.
As Egger flipped through the map pieces, Franz gave Quentin a shove, pushing him away from the door and back toward Jake.
Auf dem Turm, Deutschland siegt auf allen Fronten, Egger said, reading the banners on the map links one by one. To the tower, of course. Der verrückte König würdigt den Schwanenritter. The castle. Der Eisbär dient dem Erzherzog von Österreich und dem heiligen römischen Kaiser. The polar bears. Der Fels ist stabil, während sich die Feld dreht. Which brings us here, of course. To this place where my grandfather once stood. The rock that doesn't turn. This map is his life, Franz. He helped create it. And then he disappeared forever. Nobody ever saw him again. I believe wherever the gold is, that's where my grandfather is too. I believe he's been personally watching over the wealth of the Reich for 75 years.
The wealth stolen by the Reich, Jake said, unable to resist. And if your grandfather is with the gold, he's just a pile of bones by now.
Egger gave him another thin smile, shook his head, then returned to the last section of the map.
Der Zug fährt auf halber Strecke zum Bahnhof Strebske Plesso. The train stops halfway to where? Strebske Plesso. That's a small town in Slovakia. I don't understand this. He flipped through all five pieces of the map again, came back to the end and stared at the last link. I see how these have come together, he said. But how do you use this map once you have all of the pieces? What do all of these other symbols mean?
Quentin and Jake exchanged a quick look. They were thinking exactly the same thing. If all he needed was the map, we'd already be dead. We'll stay alive only as long as he thinks we can still help him.
Nick found another full crate not far from the first. On this one, the top was less tightly nailed down and he was able to pry it open. When he shined his light inside the crate, he saw nothing but old straw. He moved some aside to see what was underneath and heard the clank of metal on metal. He reached down and pulled out a pipe. No, a pipe with a wider section on one end. No, Nick realized. It was not a pipe at all. It was a Stielhandgranate, a vintage German hand grenade. What kind of monastery keeps a box of hand grenades next to their potatoes? Nick placed the grenade back into the straw very carefully, taking note of the pull cord, making sure that everything he did was the exact opposite of pulling or touching or even looking at that cord for too long. As soon as he had backed away from the crate, he heard two separate sets of footsteps coming down the stairs. Kate was first, taking each step with her hands raised. It's me, she said. We have company. Nick was frozen to the spot as he saw the man coming down behind her. The man's winter parka was covering his neck, but Nick would have bet anything on a Red Star tattoo. More important, he was holding some kind of submachine gun, with the barrel trained at the center of Kate's back. Take it easy, Nick said to him, raising his hands. I'm not armed. Not unless you count old German hand grenades, he thought. And I don't think that would be a great option right now. As Kate took another step, Nick realized what was about to happen, and what could happen if the next few seconds turned out the right way. He saw her intentionally keeping her flashlight above the line of the stairs, saw her pause just as she was about to reach the broken step. No need to do anything stupid, Nick said to the man, hoping to distract him just a little bit further from where his next step would be. We'll do whatever you want. Kate waited until the man was behind her. He gave her a little jab in the back with the barrel of his gun. Then as Kate took the long step to avoid the gaping hole, Nick held his breath for one half-beat, until the man's foot reached for the next step and found nothing but air. The man tried to catch himself, but it was too late, especially with both hands on the gun. He hit his head on the way down and landed flat on his back on the stone floor. Nick moved quickly to take the man's gun away. The man moaned, rolled over, and tried to get up. Kate gave the man a kick to put him back on the floor, then went up the stairs to grab some rope. She came back down, rolled the man onto his stomach and tied his hands behind his back. He was getting his wind back and started talking to her in German. Kate trained the submachine gun on him. The man stopped talking. Where's your father? Nick asked her. And my father. We need to find them. Hold on, Nick said, eyeing the rough wooden ceiling. He led her toward the opposite end of the room. As they passed the open crate, Kate looked in at the straw and asked, What did you find inside here? Just some old hand grenades. Some what? Nick put a finger to his lips, then pointed up at the ceiling. When they both stopped moving and went silent, they heard the thin sound of a voice somewhere above them.
Der Zug fährt auf halber Strecke zum Bahnhof Strebske Plesso. The train stops halfway to where? Strebske Plesso. That's a small town in Slovakia. I don't understand this.
Kate motioned for Nick to turn his light off. The same voice went on.
I see how these come together. But how do you use this map once you have all of the pieces? What do all of these other symbols mean?
Nick's and Kate's eyes adjusted to the darkness,
A thin stream of light came through the floor.
Let's move one of those crates over, Kate whispered. Maybe we can see through the cracks.
They lifted an empty crate so that it wouldn't make noise against the stone floor and moved it into position. Kate stepped up onto the top of the crate and peered through a gap in the floorboards. She saw her father, then shifted to see Nick's father. They were standing together in the center of the room above her. She heard Nick's father speak.
I just found the last link a minute ago. I haven't even had the chance to examine it yet.
I will give you 1 minute to examine it, the first voice said.
She still didn't know who this was, but the heavy German accent was unmistakable.
But do not touch them.
Kate shifted her position again to track the man as he crossed the room. She strained to catch a glimpse of his face, then bent down for a moment to put her mouth close to Nick's ear.
Remember when we were in Vitali's briefing, watching his slideshow? He showed that photo of the man whose grandfather was part of the original Brotherhood.
Klaus Egger, Nick said. The man who tried to hire my father.
I'm pretty sure the man up there right now, with the German accent, is Egger.
Nick's eyes went wide.
Who else is in the room?
She stood back up, shifting her head to scan the room.
The big guy, from the train.
You're kidding me. We have to get up there, Nick.
I would use your minute well, Mr. Fox, they heard Egger say.
The floorboards groaned as Egger paced back and forth a few times, finally stopping next to Franz in the doorway. Kate watched her father move close to Quentin.
What are you doing? Egger asked.
I'm helping him.
If you see either man touch the map, Egger said, shoot them immediately.
If they don't have answers for us in 30 more seconds, then you should also shoot them.
Kate slipped quietly off the crate.
Let's go,
she whispered to Nick.
Show me where the doorway is, Nick said, scanning the ceiling.
Kate paced off 5 steps.
Right about here.
Don't move, Nick said. He went back to the crate with the grenades, took one out, came back, and then dragged the crate over to a few feet away from where Kate was standing. It was a point that would be behind Franz and Egger, putting them between the grenade and their fathers. Jumping up onto the crate, he shined his light on the underside of the floorboards, finding a place where he could tuck the thin end of a grenade through a knothole.
No wonder my dad loves you, Kate said.
Everything I learned about mass destruction I learned from him.
Just get ready to move. In fact, start now.
Those things are so old. What if it doesn't explode?
Then we'll take our chances in a shootout.
You're in charge of the machine gun. Go!
Nick gave Kate a few seconds to move to the other end of the room. He pulled the cord, jumped off the crate, and followed, grabbing 2 more grenades on his way past the open crate, 1 in each hand.
Never know when we could use these, he thought.
When he got to the stairs, he saw that Kate had picked up the submachine gun and was waiting for him. They both went up the stairs, waiting for the grenade to explode.
Nothing is happening, Kate said.
You were right. Maybe there...
He was cut off by the blast. Quentin looked at Jake as he came closer, while Egger, standing in the doorway with Franz, consulted his watch and told them they had 30 more seconds. Jake was about to charge Franz when he thought he heard a faint scraping sound. He glanced at Quentin, then over at Egger and Franz. They all heard the faint but unmistakable murmur of a human voice.
Sounds like your children have been found, Egger said.
In German, we call the game Versteckspiel. You call it hide and seek, I believe. Your time is almost up, anyway.
He took a few steps toward them, just as the explosion ripped through the room, and the floorboards he'd been standing on were blown to pieces. To Nick's and Kate's ears, it was louder than a gunshot, but not quite as loud as the end of the world. Through their feet, they felt the impact against the wooden floor on the other side of the building. They looked at each other, hoping that the bad guys were hurting and the good guys were getting away. But before they could do anything else, the kitchen door was kicked open and another submachine gun-toting man burst into the room. He needed a moment to orient himself, coming from the light outside into the relative darkness. It had been years since Kate last handled the submachine gun like the MP7,
but she instinctively swung it into firing position. There was no need for it, as Nick had already redirected the man's stumbling momentum, guiding away the barrel of the gun with one hand, grabbing the back of the man's parka with the other. He led the man into the gaping mouth of the trap door, threw him down the stairs, and slammed the trap door shut. In the library, Jake, Quentin, and Edgar all went down to the floor, covering their heads. When they looked up, there was nothing left of the doorway but a great hole in the floor. The body of Franz was lying on the rough stones 10 feet below them. Quentin grabbed the map pieces. Edgar went for the gun in his jacket, and Jake went for Edgar. One hard shove backward, and Edgar fell through the great hole in the floor, landing hard on Franz. Quentin took a piece of a broken chair and smashed open the one window in the room. Both men climbed out and made their way through knee-deep snowdrifts, around to the other side of the monastery. "Over here," Kate called. Jake had never been happier to hear his daughter's voice. She was standing next to one of the two snowcats with Nick. "Crazy bastards rode those up," Jake said, "along the ridge." "Sounds like the best way down," Quentin said, looking back at the building. "We need to move." "Hold on," Nick said. "No need to take both snowcats down the mountain." He took out one of the hand grenades he had brought up from the basement. "Now I understand the hole in the floor," Jake said. "But be careful. They can't be stable after all these years." Jake climbed up the front tread of one of the snowcats, opened up the door, and got in behind the wheel. It took him a few seconds to figure out the controls. Then he pressed down the clutch and turned the key. The machine roared to life. The cab itself was basically a big box, with plenty of room for Kate and Quentin to get in. Nick stood by outside, waiting for the last moment. When the snowcat was ready to go, he opened the door to the other vehicle, pulled the cord on the grenade, and threw it inside. He hustled back and jumped in beside Jake, who was already engaging the clutch. Jake hit the gas. The snowcat's treads whined on the ice for a second time before finding purchase, and they were off. 2 seconds later, Edgar and Franz came out of the building. "What is that goon made of?" Kate said. "He's unkillable." "Think so? Just watch." Jake had to keep his eyes on the old tracks in the snow as he drove away from the building, but everyone else was watching the two men get into the other snowcat. Edgar was behind the wheel, while Franz had to squeeze himself in through the other door. "Come on," Nick said. "Blow!" The other snowcat roared to life. Franz was still trying to get his huge body inside the cab. "Blow already!" With Franz finally in, even before he could close the door, Edgar put the vehicle in gear and it jumped forward. "Damn," Nick said. "Why didn't it blow up?" "You pull that cord. It's like dragging a 75-year-old match to light the fuse," Jake said, still focused on keeping the treads within the old tracks. "I'm surprised that first one worked at all." "I got one left," Nick said. "Maybe this one's still good." "I wouldn't count on it," Jake said. Jake grimaced as they left the relatively flat ground on which the monastery had been built. The other snowcat was barely 100 yards behind them, but the ridge suddenly got perilously thin. So thin that the treads on the snowcat could barely straddle it. When he slipped off the line for just 1 second, they all felt the impact of rock and ice against the undercarriage. "I can't go any faster," Jake said. The gunfire erupted from behind them, strafing the back of the vehicle with bullets from Franz's submachine gun. "Everybody down," Kate said, as the back window was shattered by the next round of fire. They were moving east, away from the Matterhorn, toward a smaller peak called Furghorn. Jake kept fighting to keep the snowcat on its narrow line, feeling the vehicle threatening to tip over whenever he veered even a few inches in either direction. The wind kicked up, rocking the cab and making his job even harder. The back of the cab was hit by another round of bullets from the submachine gun. Kate picked up the submachine gun she'd brought with her, pointed it out the back of the vehicle, and returned fire. But it was like shooting while riding a bucking bronco. "Everybody hold on," Jake said. He knew he couldn't keep following the old tracks, not while being shot at from behind. He had to get off this ridge. When he threw the wheel to the left, the vehicle dove, heading straight down at a precipitous angle and already starting to slide. Jake kept the nose pointed forward, steering into the slide.
He knew if the snowcat went sideways, it would go into a roll and probably turn a few hundred times before finally reaching the bottom several minutes later. Kate tried to hold onto a handle mounted into the inside of the cab. She turned to look behind her through the shattered rear window and saw the second snowcat making the same turn. "They're still on our tail," she said. Jake kept fighting, looking ahead to a slightly more level area about 100 yards ahead of them. But then they started to spin, and Jake couldn't fight it any longer. He lost all control as they turned all the way around, sliding backward and looking straight up at the other snowcat, until they hit yet another ice patch and completed the turn, coming around a full 360 degrees and regaining their bearings. The ground leveled, the ice softened, and the treads finally gripped, slowing the vehicle down and nearly throwing them all through the windshield. The snow got deeper here as they lost elevation. The treads worked harder and harder to churn through it, slowing them down. On top of that, Jake saw that they would be entering a narrow canyon between two great rock outcroppings, and he knew he'd have to keep the snowcat away from the walls. As they came over a crest, he saw a deep crevice running down the center of the canyon. He had to slow down even more so he could carefully negotiate either left or right of it. He pumped at the brakes, feeling the treads sinking in the snow. "They're gaining on us," Kate said from behind him. Nick took the last grenade from his coat, pulled the cord, leaned out the window, and threw it as far as he could, directly behind them. The grenade landed in the deep snow and disappeared. The other snowcat churned over the spot and kept coming. "Another dud," Nick said. "I demand a refund." 3 more seconds passed. Then this grenade exploded. The other vehicle was well past it, beyond danger of any damage. But then the snow started moving. It was like a gentle white wave at first. Then it got bigger and bigger, feeding on the new snow it picked up as it rushed down the slope, faster and faster. "We're going to get buried," Quentin said. "No, we're not," Jake said, pushing the vehicle onto the left edge of the crevice, hugging the rock wall until it gave way to a wider spot that created a safe haven, a snowbreak against the coming avalanche. Jake stopped the vehicle to ride out whatever would come next. Behind them, Edgar struggled to follow the same line, but the tidal wave of snow was already building against the back of his snowcat, pushing him toward the great crevice. Jake, Quentin, Nick, and Kate all watched as Edgar's door flew open and he jumped out of the vehicle, rolling in the snow and coming to a stop against the rock wall. The other door was open and Franz was fighting his way out. But it was too late. The snowcat went over the edge of the crevice, falling 100 feet to the bare rocks below. It landed with a sickening crash and the avalanche flowed over the crevice, filling it completely with snow. With its volume and speed reduced, the last of the avalanche flowed past the first snowcat, pushing snow up to the bottom of the cab, but rising no farther. When it was all done, there was nothing to see but a new expanse of snow in the canyon that had erased the crevice. Surely, this time Franz was dead. But what about Edgar? They spotted him clinging to the rock wall, having found a slight snowbreak just as they had. He was stranded on the mountain in deep snow, but still alive. Nick leaned out of his window to give Edgar a proper salute, then added to that another hand gesture entirely. Jake put the vehicle back in gear and headed down toward the Swiss town of Zermatt. They parked the snowcat next to the gondola station in Zermatt and quietly slipped away into the town. Quentin had cell reception again, so he called Professor Lewis back on the other side of the mountain and asked him to load everything into the Peugeot and drive through the pass into Switzerland. They waited in a cafe, looking like 4 exhausted climbers recovering after a hard day on the mountain. They ordered food and hot coffee. It felt good to be breathing air with adequate oxygen again. "Do you have it?" Kate finally asked Quentin. Quentin gave her a tired smile and patted the money belt around his waist. "Was that really the last link? Are we really done?" "I don't know. We'll have to let the professor look at it. I hope so." An hour later, Professor Lewis showed up in Zermatt. He was excited to see the last link in the map. but they didn't want to stay here in this town, not right at the base of the mountain. Instead, they drove north into the interior of Switzerland, stopping in the town of Brig and finding another low-profile inn for the night. They got 3 rooms and gathered in one as Professor Lewis pored over the 5 links they hoped would constitute a complete treasure map, leading them finally to the Raubgold. The polar bear scrapes on Nick's leg had been redressed. The new cut on his eyebrow was taped shut with a butterfly bandage. Jake's re-aggravated swollen ankle was soaking in a bucket of ice. Quentin was still recovering from a long day without enough oxygen, wrapped up in a blanket and trying to get warm. Kate was just tired as hell. They all watched Professor Lewis going through the pieces of the map one by one. First, he ran them in a line across the desk, left to right. Then he switched it to top to bottom.
"The good news is," he finally said, "there's a rune here, called Yera, at the bottom of the banner. It means harvest. A task fulfilled. That would suggest that this map is complete, and all we have to do is follow this last banner to find the treasure."
"What does that banner say again?" Quentin asked.
"It says, Der Zug fährt auf Hauptstrecke zum Bahnhof Strebske Plesso. The train stops halfway to Strebske Plesso, which I believe is a town in Slovakia, in the High Tatra Mountains."
"Okay. So we go halfway to that station. But halfway from where?"
"That's a good question," Lewis said. "Here's where I was expecting the rest of the map to help us. All of these topographical lines, and all of the symbols."
He held up the last link.
"Here's Fehu," he said, pointing to a symbol near the center. "It means wealth, and it doesn't appear anywhere else on any of these other links. This must be where the gold is."
"Okay, so how do we get there?"
Professor Lewis shook his head in frustration.
"I don't know. It's almost like you have to start over on this first page with one of these symbols and follow that to the next one, then the next one, and the next one."
He kept staring at the map. He didn't move. He didn't make a sound. Nick and Kate sat on one of the beds, waiting. Quentin stayed wrapped up on the other bed. Jake rattled the ice in his bucket. Lewis looked up from the map and stared at Jake.
"Sorry," Jake said.
A few more minutes passed. Having 4 people watching him so intently was too much for Professor Lewis, and he stacked the pieces into a pile so he could take them back to his own room. He paused, staring at the map pieces stacked on top of each other. He flipped from the first to the second, all the way to the 5th.
"They're layers," he exclaimed. "This is how the runes line up. It all makes sense now."
He traced how the seemingly random lines actually formed one complete trail, with matching runes leading from one layer of the map to the layer below it, all the way to the bottom, where Fehu, the treasure, was waiting.
"The map is 3-dimensional, he said, "leading underground."
When he looked up, 4 sets of eyes were staring at him.
"I believe we need to start planning our trip to Strebske Plesso," Lewis said.
"Are you telling us," Nick said, "that you figured out the map?"
"That is what I am telling you, yes."
"We're going to need to be extra careful on this one," Nick said. "If Egger made it off the mountain and is still alive, he knows this last piece leads in the direction of Strebske Plesso."
"So by the time we get there," Kate said, "or maybe soon after, Egger's men will be there too."